When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Domitian, Part 2, from the Lives of the 12 Caesars, by Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by David Leeson. The Lives of the 12 Caesars, by Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus. Translated by Alexander Thompson and edited by T. Forrester. Domitian, Part 2, Paragraphs 11 through 23. His cruelties were not only excessive, but subtle and unexpected. The day before he crucified a collector of his rents, he sent for him into his bedchamber, made him sit down upon the bed by him, and sent him away well pleased, and, so far as could be inferred from his treatment, in a state of perfect security, having vouchsafed him the favor of a plate of meat from his own table. When he was on the point of condemning to death Aretinus Clemens, a man of consular rank, and one of his friends and emissaries, he retained him about his person in the same or greater favor than ever, until at last, as they were riding together in the same litter, upon seeing the man who had informed against him, he said, "Are you willing that we should hear this base slave to-morrow?" Contemptuously abusing the patience of men, he never pronounced a severe sentence without prefacing it with words which gave hopes of mercy, so that at last there was not a more certain token of a fatal conclusion than a mild commencement. He brought before the Senate some person accused of treason, declaring that he should prove that day how dear he was to the Senate, and so influence them that they condemned the accused to be punished according to the ancient usage. Then, as if alarmed at the extreme severity of their punishment, to lessen the odiousness of the proceeding, he interposed in these words, for it is not foreign to the purpose to give them precisely as they were delivered, "Permit me, conscript fathers, so far to prevail upon your affection for me, however extraordinary the request may seem, as to grant the condemned criminals the favor of dying in the manner they choose. For by so doing, ye will spare your own eyes, and the world will understand that I interceded with the Senate on their behalf." Having exhausted the exchequer by the expense of his buildings and public spectacles, with the augmentation of pay lately granted to the troops, he made an attempt at the reduction of the army in order to lessen the military charges. But reflecting that he should, by this measure, expose himself to the insults of the barbarians, while it would not suffice to extricate him from his embarrassments, he had recourse to plundering his subjects by every mode of exaction. The estates of the living and the dead were sequestered upon any accusation, by whomsoever preferred. The unsupported allegation of any one person, relative to a word or action construed to affect the dignity of the emperor, was sufficient. Inheritances, to which he had not the slightest pretension, were confiscated. If there was found so much as one person to say he had heard from the deceased when living that he had made the emperor his heir. Besides the exactions from others, the poll tax on the Jews was levied with extreme rigor, both on those who lived after the manner of Jews in the city, without publicly professing themselves to be such, and on those who, by concealing their origin, avoided paying the tribute imposed upon that people. I remember, when I was a youth, to have been present when an old man, 90 years of age, had his person exposed to view in a very crowded court, in order that, on inspection, the procurator might satisfy himself whether he was circumcised. From his earliest years, Domitian was anything but courteous, of a forward, assuming disposition, and extravagant both in his words and actions. When Caenis, his father's concubine, upon her return from Istria, offered him a kiss, as she had been used to do, he presented her his hand to kiss, being indignant that his brother's son-in-law should be waited on by servants dressed in white, he exclaimed, "Uk agathon polikoi ranyi, too many princes are not good." After he became emperor, he had the assurance to boast in the Senate that he had bestowed the empire on his father and brother, and they had restored it to him. And upon taking his wife again after the divorce, he declared by proclamation that he had recalled her to his pulviner. He was not a little pleased, too, at hearing the acclamations of the people in the amphitheater on a day of festival, "All happiness to our Lord and Lady." But when, during the celebration of the Capitoline trial of skill, the whole concourse of people entreated him with one voice to restore Palfurius Sura to his place in the Senate, from which he had been long before expelled, he having then carried away the prize of eloquence from all the orators who had contended for it, he did not vouchsafe to give them any answer, but only commanded silence to be proclaimed by the voice of the crier. With equal arrogance, when he dictated the form of a letter to be used by his procurators, he began it thus: "Our Lord and God commands so-and-so," whence it became a rule that no one should style him otherwise either in writing or speaking. He suffered no statues to be erected for him in the capital, unless they were of gold and silver, and of a certain weight. He erected so many magnificent gates and arches, surmounted by representations of chariots drawn by four horses, and other triumphal ornaments, in different quarters of the city, that a wag inscribed on one of the arches the Greek word axke, "It is enough." He filled the office of consul 17 times, which no one had ever done before him, and for the 7 middle occasions in successive years, but in scarcely any of them had he more than the title, for he never continued in office beyond the calends of May, and for the most part only till the Ides of January. After his 2 triumphs, when he assumed the cognomen of Germanicus, he called the months of September and October Germanicus and Domitian, after his own names, because he commenced his reign in the one and was born in the other. Becoming by these means universally feared and odious, he was at last taken off by a conspiracy of his friends and favorite freedmen, in concert with his wife. He had long entertained a suspicion of the year and day when he should die, and even of the very hour and manner of his death, all which he had learned from the Chaldeans, when he was a very young man. His father once at supper laughed at him for refusing to eat some mushrooms, saying that if he knew his fate, he would rather be afraid of the sword. Being therefore in perpetual apprehension and anxiety, he was keenly alive to the slightest suspicions, insomuch that he is thought to have withdrawn the edict ordering the destruction of the vines, chiefly because the copies of it which were dispersed had the following lines written upon them: "Keen me fagis epi risonomos epi cartophoriso. Gnaw thou my root, yet shall my juice suffice to pour on Caesar's head in sacrifice." It was from the same principle of fear that he refused a new honor, devised and offered him by the Senate, though he was greedy of all such compliments. It was this, that as often as he held the consulship, Roman knights, chosen by lot, should walk before him, clad in the trabia, with lances in their hands, amongst his lictors and apparitors. As the time of the danger which he apprehended drew near, he became daily more and more disturbed in mind, insomuch that he lined the walls of the porticos in which he used to walk with the stone called Phengates, by the reflection of which he could see every object behind him. He seldom gave an audience to persons in custody, unless in private, being alone, and he himself holding their chains in his hand. To convince his domestics that the life of a master was not to be attempted upon any pretext, however plausible, he condemned to death Epaphroditus his secretary, because it was believed that he had assisted Nero, in his extremity, to kill himself. His last victim was Flavius Clemens, his cousin German, a man below contempt for his want of energy, whose sons, then of a very tender age, he had avowedly destined for his successors, and discarding their former names, had ordered one to be called Vespasian, and the other Domitian. Nevertheless, he suddenly put him to death upon some very slight suspicion, almost before he was well out of his consulship. By this violent act he very much hastened his own destruction. During 8 months together there was so much lightning at Rome, and such accounts of the phenomenon were brought from other parts, that at last he cried out, "Let him now strike whom he will." The Capitol was struck by lightning, as well as the temple of the Flavian family, with the Palatine house, and his own bedchamber. The tablet also, inscribed upon the base of his triumphal statue, was carried away by the violence of the storm, and fell upon a neighboring monument. The tree which just before the advancement of Vespasian had been prostrated and rose again, suddenly fell to the ground. The goddess Fortune of Praeneste, to whom it was his custom on New Year's Day to commend the empire for the ensuing year, and who had always given him a favorable reply, at last returned him a melancholy answer, not without mention of blood. He dreamt that Minerva, whom he worshipped even to a superstitious excess, was withdrawing from her sanctuary, declaring she could protect him no longer, because she was disarmed by Jupiter. Nothing, however, so much affected him as an answer given by Ascletario, the astrologer, and his subsequent fate. This person had been informed against, and did not deny his having predicted some future events of which, from the principles of his art, he confessed he had a foreknowledge. Domitian asked him what end he thought he should come to himself, to which replying, "I shall in short time be torn to pieces by dogs," he ordered him immediately to be slain, and, in order to demonstrate the vanity of his art, to be carefully buried. But during the preparations for executing this order, it happened that the funeral pile was blown down by a sudden storm, and the body, half burnt, was torn to pieces by dogs, which being observed by Latinus, the comic actor, as he chanced to pass that way, he told it, amongst the other news of the day, to the emperor at supper. The day before his death he ordered some dates served up at table, to be kept till the next day, adding, "If I have the luck to use them." And turning to those who were nearest him, he said, "Tomorrow the moon in Aquarius will be bloody instead of watery, and an event will happen, which will be much talked of all the world over." About midnight, he was so terrified that he leaped out of bed. That morning he tried and passed sentence on a soothsayer sent from Germany, who, being consulted about the lightning that had lately happened, predicted from it a change of government. The blood running down his face as he scratched an ulcerous tumor on his forehead, he said, "Would this were all that is to befall me." Then, upon his asking the time of the day, instead of 5 o'clock, which was the hour he dreaded, they purposely told him it was 6. Overjoyed at this information, as if all danger were now past, and hastening to the bath, Parthenius, his chamberlain, stopped him, by saying that there was a person come to wait upon him about a matter of great importance, which would admit of no delay. Upon this, ordering all persons to withdraw, he retired into his chamber, and was there slain. Concerning the contrivance and mode of his death, the common account is this. The conspirators being in some doubt when and where they should attack him, whether he was in the bath or at supper, Stephanus, a steward of Domitilla's, then under prosecution for defrauding his mistress, offered them his advice and assistance, and wrapping up his left arm as if it was hurt in wool and bandages for some days to prevent suspicion, at the hour appointed he secreted a dagger in them, pretending then to make a discovery of conspiracy, and being for that reason admitted, he presented to the emperor a memorial, and while he was reading it in great astonishment, stabbed him in the groin. But Domitian, though wounded, making resistance, Clodianus, one of his guards, Maximus, a freedman of Parthenius's, Sartorius, his principal chamberlain, with some gladiators, fell upon him and stabbed him in 7 places. A boy who had the charge of the Lares in his bedchamber, and was then in attendance as usual, gave these further particulars, that he was ordered by Domitian, upon receiving his first wound, to reach him a dagger which lay under his pillow, and call in his domestics, but that he found nothing at the head of the bed, excepting the hilt of a poniard, and that all the doors were fastened. That the emperor in the meantime got hold of Stephanus, and throwing him upon the ground, struggled a long time with him, one while endeavoring to wrench the dagger from him, another while, though his fingers were miserably mangled, to tear out his eyes. He was slain upon the 14th of the calends of October, in the 45th year of his age, and the 15th of his reign. His corpse was carried out upon a common bier by the public bearers, and buried by his nurse Phyllis, at his suburban villa on the Latin Way. But she afterwards privately conveyed his remains to the temple of the Flavian family, and mingled them with the ashes of Julia, the daughter of Titus, whom she had also nursed. He was tall in stature, his face modest and very ruddy. He had large eyes, but was dim-sighted. Naturally graceful in his person, particularly in his youth, excepting only that his toes were bent somewhat inward, he was at last disfigured by baldness, corpulence, and the slenderness of his legs, which were reduced by a long illness. He was so sensible how much the modesty of his countenance recommended him, that he once made this boast to the Senate: "Thus far you have approved both of my disposition and my countenance." His baldness so much annoyed him, that he considered it an affront to himself, if any other person was reproached with it, either in jest or in earnest, though in a small tract he published, addressed to a friend, concerning the preservation of the hair, he uses for their mutual consolation the words following: "Uch oraas oios cago kalos te megas te. Seest thou my graceful mien, my stately form? And yet the fate of my hair awaits me. However, I bear with fortitude this loss of my hair while I am still young. Remember that nothing is more fascinating than beauty, but nothing of shorter duration." He so shrunk from undergoing fatigue that he scarcely ever walked through the city on foot. In his expeditions and on a march, he seldom rode on horseback, but was generally carried in a litter. He had no inclination for the exercise of arms, but was very expert in the use of the bow. Many persons have seen him often kill 100 wild animals of various kinds at his Alban retreat, and fix his arrows in their heads with such dexterity that he could, in 2 shots, plant them, like a pair of horns, in each. He would sometimes direct his arrows against the hand of a boy standing at a distance, and expanded as a mark, with such precision that they all passed between the boy's fingers without hurting him. In the beginning of his reign, he gave up the study of the liberal sciences, though he took care to restore, at a vast expense, the libraries which had been burnt down, collecting manuscripts from all parts, and sending scribes to Alexandria, either to copy or correct them. Yet he never gave himself the trouble of reading history or poetry, or of employing his pen even for his private purposes. He perused nothing but the commentaries and acts of Tiberius Caesar. His letters, speeches, and edicts were all drawn up for him by others, though he could converse with elegance, and sometimes expressed himself in memorable sentiments. "I could wish," said he once, "that I was but as handsome as Metius fancies himself to be." And of the head of someone whose hair was partly reddish and partly gray, he said that it was snow sprinkled with mead. "The lot of princes," he remarked, "was very miserable, for no one believed them when they discovered a conspiracy until they were murdered." When he had leisure, he amused himself with dice, even on days that were not festivals, and in the morning. He went to the bath early, and made a plentiful dinner, insomuch that he seldom ate more at supper than a Matian apple, to which he added a draught of wine out of a small flask. He gave frequent and splendid entertainments, but they were soon over, for he never prolonged them after sunset, and indulged in no revel after. For, till bedtime, he did nothing else but walk by himself in private. He was insatiable in his lusts, calling frequent commerce with women, as if it was a sort of exercise, clinopaline, bed-wrestling. And it was reported that he plucked the hair from his concubines and swam about in company with the lowest prostitutes. His brother's daughter was offered him in marriage when she was a virgin, but being at that time enamored of Domitia, he obstinately refused her. Yet not long afterwards, when she was given to another, he was ready enough to debauch her, and that even while Titus was living. But after she had lost both her father and her husband, he loved her most passionately, and without disguise, insomuch that he was the occasion of her death by obliging her to procure a miscarriage when she was with child by him. The people showed little concern at his death, but the soldiers were roused by it to great indignation, and immediately endeavored to have him ranked among the gods. They were also ready to revenge his loss, if there had been any to take the lead. However, they soon after effected it, by resolutely demanding the punishment of all those who had been concerned in his assassination. On the other hand, the Senate was so overjoyed that they met in all haste, and in a full assembly reviled his memory in the most bitter terms, ordering ladders to be brought in, and his shields and images to be pulled down before their eyes, and dashed in pieces upon the floor of the Senate House, passing at the same time a decree to obliterate his titles everywhere, and abolish all memory of him. A few months before he was slain, a raven on the Capitol uttered these words, "All will be well." Some person gave the following interpretation of this prodigy: "Nuper tarpeo quae sedit culmine cornix, est bene, non potuit dicere, dixit, erit. Late croaked a raven from Tarpeia's height, all is not yet, but shall be, right." They say, likewise, that Domitian dreamed that a golden hump grew out of the back of his neck, which he considered as a certain sign of happy days for the empire after him. Such an auspicious change indeed shortly afterwards took place, through the justice and moderation of the succeeding emperors. End of Domitian.
Lives of the Eminent Grammarians, Part 1, of the Lives of the 12 Caesars, by Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Lini. The Lives of the 12 Caesars by Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus, translated by Alexander Thompson and edited by T. Forrester. Lives of the Eminent Grammarians, Part 1. The science of grammar was, in ancient times, far from being in vogue at Rome. Indeed, it was of little use in a rude state of society, when the people were engaged in constant wars, and had not much time to bestow on the cultivation of the liberal arts. At the outset, its pretensions were very slender, for the earliest men of learning, who were both poets and orators, may be considered as half-Greek. I speak of Livius and Ennius, who are acknowledged to have taught both languages as well at Rome as in foreign parts. But they only translated from the Greek, and if they composed anything of their own in Latin, it was only from what they had before read. For although there are those who say that this Ennius published two books, one on letters and syllables, and the other on meters, Lucius Cotta has satisfactorily proved that they are not the works of the poet Ennius, but of another writer of the same name, to whom also the treatise on the rules of augury is attributed. Crates of Malus, then, was, in our opinion, the first who introduced the study of grammar at Rome. He was contemporary with Aristarchus, and having been sent by King Attalus as envoy to the Senate, in the interval between the Second and Third Punic Wars, soon after the death of Ennius, he had the misfortune to fall into an open sewer in the Palatine quarter of the city and broke his leg. After which, during the whole period of his embassy and convalescence, he gave frequent lectures, taking much pains to instruct his hearers, and he has left us an example well worthy of imitation. It was so far followed that poems hitherto little known, the works either of deceased friends or other approved writers, were brought to light, and, being read and commented on, were explained to others. Thus, Caius Octavius Lampadio edited the Punic War of Nevius, which, having been written in one volume without any break in the manuscript, he divided into 7 books. After that, Quintus Varganteius undertook the Annals of Ennius, which he read on certain fixed days to crowded audiences. So Lelius Archelaus and Vectius Philocomus read and commented on the satires of their friend Lucilius, which Linnaeus Pompeius, a freedman, tells us he studied under Archelaus, and Valerius Cato under Philocomus. 2 others also taught and promoted grammar in various branches, namely Lucius Aelius Lanuvinus, the son-in-law of Quintus Aelius, and Servius Claudius, both of whom were Roman knights, and men who rendered great services both to learning and the Republic. Lucius Aelius had a double cognomen, for he was called Precanius, because his father was a herald, Stilo, because he was in the habit of composing orations for most of the speakers of highest rank. Indeed, he was so strong a partisan of the nobles that he accompanied Quintus Metellus Numidicus in his exile. Servius, having clandestinely obtained his father-in-law's book before it was published, was disowned for the fraud, which he took so much to heart that, overwhelmed with shame and distress, he retired from Rome. And being seized with a fit of the gout, in his impatience, he applied a poisonous ointment to his feet, which half killed him, so that his lower limbs mortified while he was still alive. After this, more attention was paid to the science of letters, and it grew in public estimation, insomuch that men of the highest rank did not hesitate in undertaking to write something on the subject. And it is related that sometimes there were no less than 20 celebrated scholars in Rome. So high was the value, and so great were the rewards of grammarians, that Latacius Daphnidis, jocularly called Pan's Herd, by Linnaeus Melissus, was purchased by Quintus Catulus for 200,000 sesterces, and shortly afterwards made a freedman. And that Lucius Apuleius, who was taken into the pay of Apicius Calvinus, a wealthy Roman knight, at the annual salary of 10,000 crowns, had many scholars. Grammar also penetrated into the provinces, and some of the most eminent amongst the learned taught it in foreign parts, particularly in Gallia Togata. In the number of these we may reckon Octavius Teucer, Sisenius Jacques, and Oppius Carus, who persisted in teaching to a most advanced period of his life, at a time when he was not only unable to walk, but his sight failed. The appellation of grammarian was borrowed from the Greeks, but at first the Latins called such persons literati. Cornelius Nepos, also in his book, where he draws a distinction between a literate and a philologist, says that in common phrase those are properly called literati, who are skilled in speaking or writing with care or accuracy, and those more specially deserve the name who translated the poets, and were called grammarians by the Greeks. It appears that they were named literators by Messala Corvinus, in one of his letters, when he says that it does not refer to Furius Bibaculus, not even to Sigida, nor to Cato the literator, meaning, doubtless, that Valerius Cato was both a poet and an eminent grammarian. Some there are who draw a distinction between a literati and a literator, as the Greeks do between a grammarian and a grammatist, applying the former term to men of real erudition, the latter to those whose pretensions to learning are moderate. And this opinion Orbilius supports by examples. For he says that in old times, when a company of slaves was offered for sale by any person, it was not customary, without good reason, to describe either of them in the catalogue as a literati, but only as a literator, meaning that he was not a proficient in letters, but had a smattering of knowledge. The early grammarians taught rhetoric also, and we have many of their treatises which include both sciences. Whence it arose, I think, that in later times, although the two professions had then become distinct, the old custom was retained, or the grammarians introduced into their teaching some of the elements required for public speaking, such as the problem, the periphrasis, the choice of words, description of character, and the like. In order that they might not transfer their pupils to the rhetoricians no better than ill-taught boys. But I perceive that these lessons are now given up in some cases, on account of the want of application, or the tender years of the scholar, for I do not believe that it arises from any dislike in the master. I recollect that when I was a boy, it was the custom of one of these, whose name was Princeps, to take alternate days for declaiming and disputing, and sometimes he would lecture in the morning and declaim in the afternoon, when he had his pulpit removed. I heard also that even within the memories of our own fathers, some of the pupils of the grammarians passed directly from the schools to the courts, and at once took a high place in the ranks of the most distinguished advocates. The professors at that time were, indeed, men of great eminence, of some of whom I may be able to give an account in the following chapters. Savius Nicanor first acquired fame and reputation by his teaching. And, besides, he made commentaries, the greater part of which, however, are said to have been borrowed. He also wrote a satire, in which he informs us that he was a freedman and had a double cognomen, in the following verses. Saevius Nicanor Marci Libertus negabit, Saevius Postumius idem, sed Marcus docebit. What Savius Nicanor, the freedman of Marcus, will deny, the same Savius, called also Postumius Marcus, will assert. It is reported that, in consequence of some infamy attached to his character, he retired to Sardinia, and there ended his days. Aurelius Appius, the freedman of some Epicurean, first taught philosophy, then rhetoric, and less of all, grammar. Having closed his school, he followed Rutilius Rufus when he was banished to Asia, and there the two friends grew old together. He also wrote several volumes on a variety of learned topics, nine books of which he distinguished by the number and names of the nine muses. As he says, not without reason, they being the patrons of authors and poets. I observe that its title is given in several indexes by a single letter, but he uses two in the heading of a book called Pinnix. Marcus Antonius Nepho, free-born native of Gaul, was exposed in his infancy, and afterwards received his freedom from his foster father, and, as some say, was educated at Alexandria, where Dionysius Scitobrachion was his fellow pupil. This, however, I am not very ready to believe, as the times at which they flourished scarcely agree. He is said to have been a man of great genius, of singular memory, well-read in Greek as well as Latin, and of a most obliging and agreeable temper, who never haggled about remuneration, but generally left it to the liberality of his scholars. He first taught in the house of Julius Caesar, when the latter was yet but a boy, and afterwards in his own private house. He gave instruction in rhetoric also, teaching the rules of eloquence every day, but declaiming only on festivals. It is said that some very celebrated men frequented his school, and, among others, Marcus Cicero, during the time he held the praetorship. He wrote a number of works, although he did not live beyond his 50th year. But Ateius, the philologist, says that he left only two volumes, De Latino Sermone, and that the other works ascribed to him were composed by his disciples, and were not his, although his name is sometimes to be found in them. Marcus Pompilius Andronicus, a native of Syria, while he professed to be a grammarian, was considered an idle follower of the Epicurean sect, and little qualified to be a master of a school. Finding, therefore, that at Rome, Not only Antonius Nepho, but even other teachers of less note were preferred to him. He retired to Cumae, where he lived at his ease. And, though he wrote several books, he was so needy and reduced to such straits as to be compelled to sell that excellent little work of his, the Index to the Annals, for 16,000 sesterces. Orbilius had informed us that he redeemed this work from the oblivion into which it had fallen, and took care to have it published with the author's name. Orbilius Papillus of Beneventum, being left an orphan by the death of his parents, who both fell a sacrifice to the plots of their enemies on the same day, acted at first as a praetor to the magistrates. He then joined the troops in Macedonia, when he was first decorated with the plumed helmet, and afterwards promoted to serve on horseback. Having completed his military service, he resumed his studies, which he had pursued with no small diligence from his youth upwards. And, having been a professor for a long period in his own country, at last, during the consulship of Cicero, made his way to Rome, where he taught with more reputation than profit. For, in one of his works, he says that he was then very old and lived in a garret. He also published a book with the title of Periologus, containing complaints of the injurious treatment to which professors submitted, without seeking redress at the hands of parents. His sour temper betrayed itself, not only in his disputes with the sophists opposed to him, whom he lashed on every occasion, but also towards his scholars, as Horace tells us, who calls him a flogger, and Domitius Marsus, who says of him, Si quos Orbilius ferulas cuticaque cecidit, if those Orbilius with rod or ferule threshed. And not even men of rank escaped his sarcasms, for, before he became noticed, happening to be examined as a witness in a crowded court, Varro, the advocate on the other side, put the question to him, what he did, and by what profession he gained his livelihood. He replied that he lived by removing hunchbacks from the sunshine into the shade, alluding to Murena's deformity. He lived till he was near 100 years old, but he had long lost his memory, as the verse of Bibaculus informs us. Orbilius ubinam est literarum oblivio. Where is Orbilius now, that wreck of learning lost? His statue is shown in the Capitol at Beneventum. It stands on the left hand, and is sculptured in marble, representing him in a sitting posture, wearing the pallium, with two writing cases in his hand. He left a son, named also Orbilius, who, like his father, was a professor of grammar. Ateius, the philologist, a freedman, was born at Athens. Of him, Capito Ateius, the well-known jurisconsult, says that he was a rhetorician among the grammarians, and a grammarian among the rhetoricians. Asinius Pollio, in the book in which he finds fault with the writings of Sallust for his great affectation of obsolete words, speaks thus. In this work, his chief assistant was a certain Ateius, a man of rank, a splendid Latin grammarian, the aider and preceptor of those who studied the practice of declamation. In short, one who claimed from himself the cognomen of philologus. Writing to Lysias Hermas, he says, that he had made great proficiency in Greek literature and some in Latin, that he had been a hearer of Antonius Nepho and his Hermas, and afterwards began to teach others. Moreover, that he had for pupils many illustrious youths, among whom were the two brothers Appius and Pulcher Claudius, and that he even accompanied them to their province. He appears to have assumed the name of Philologus, because, like Eratosthenes, who first adopted that cognomen, he was in high repute for his rich and varied stores of learning, which indeed it was evident from his commentaries, though but few of them are extant. Another letter, however, to the same Hermas, shows that they were very numerous. Remember, it says, to recommend generally our extracts, which we have collected, as you know, of all kinds, into 800 books. He afterwards formed an intimate acquaintance with Caius Sallustius, and on his death with Asinius Pollio. and when they undertook to write a history, he supplied the one with short annals of all Roman affairs, from which he could select at pleasure, and the other with rules on the art of composition. I am, therefore, surprised that Asinius Pollio should have supposed that he was in the habit of collecting old words and figures of speech for Sallust, when he must have known that his own advice was that none but well-known and common and appropriate expressions should be made use of, and that, above all things, the obscurity of the style of Sallust and his bold freedom in translations should be avoided. End of Lives of the Eminent Grammarians, Part 1. Recording by Leni, Rio de Janeiro, 2008. Lives of the Eminent Grammarians, Part 2, of the Lives of the 12 Caesars, by Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Leni. The Lives of the 12 Caesars, by Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus, translated by Alexander Thompson and edited by T. Forster. Lives of Eminent Grammarians, Part 2. Valerio Scato was, as some have informed us, the freedman of one Bersenus, a native of Gaul. He himself tells us in his little work called Indignatio that he was born free, and being left an orphan, was exposed to be easily stripped of his patrimony during the license of Sylla's administrations. He had a great number of distinguished pupils, and was highly esteemed as a preceptor suited to those who had a poetical turn, as appears from these short lines. Cato grammaticus latina siren, qui solus legit ac facit poetas. Cato, the Latin siren, grammar taught and verse, to form the poets skilled and poetry rehearse. Besides his treatise on grammar, he composed some poems, of which his Lydia and Diana are most admired. Tacita mentions his Lydia. Lydia, doctorum maxima cura liber. Lydia, a work to men of learning dear. Cinna thus notices the Diana. Secula permaneat nostri Diana Catonis. Immortal be our Cato's song of Diana. He lived to extreme old age, but in the lowest state of penury, and almost in actual want, having retired to a small cottage when he gave up his Tusculan villa to his creditors, as Bibaculus tells us. Si quis forte mei domum Catonis, de pictas minio asulas et illos, custodis vidit hortulos Priapi, miratur, quibus ille disciplinis, tantam sit sapientiam assecutus, quam tres cauliculi et celibra faris, racemi duo, tegula sub una, ad summam propri nutriant senectam. If perchance anyone has seen the house of my Cato, with marble slabs of the richest hues, and his gardens worthy of having Priapus for their guardian, he may well wonder by what philosophy he has gained so much wisdom, that a daily allowance of 3 culverts, 1/2 pound of meal, and 2 bunches of grapes under a narrow roof, should serve for his subsistence to extreme old age. And he says in another place, Catonis modo Galli Tusculanum, tota creditor urbe venditabat, mirati sumus unicum magistrum, sumum grammaticum, optimum poetam, omnes solvere posse quaestionis, unum difficile expedire nomen, en cor zeno doti, en iecur cratetis. We lately saw, my Gallus, Cato's Tusculan villa exposed to public sale by his creditors, and wondered that such an unrivalled master of the schools, most eminent grammarian and accomplished poet, could solve all propositions, and yet found one question too difficult for him to settle: how to pay his debts. We find in him the genius of Zenodotus, the wisdom of Crates. Cornelius Epicadius, a freedman of Lucius Cornelius Sylla, the dictator, was his apparitor in the augural priesthood, and much beloved by his son Faustus, so that he was proud to call himself the freedman of both. He completed the last book of Sylla's commentaries, which his patron had left unfinished. Liberius Hiera was bought by his master out of a slave dealer's cage, and obtained his freedom on account of his devotion to learning. It is reported that his disinterestedness was such that he gave gratuitous instruction to the children of those who were proscribed in the time of Sylla. Curtius Nicia was the intimate friend of Gnaeus Pompeius and Caius Memmius, but, having carried notes from Memmius to Pompey's wife, when she was debauched by Memmius, Pompey was indignant and forbade him his house. He was also on familiar terms with Marcus Cicero, who thus speaks of him in his epistle to Dolabella: "I have more need of receiving letters from you than you have of desiring them from me. For there is nothing going on at Rome in which I think you would take any interest, except, perhaps, that you may like to know that I am appointed umpire between our friends Nicias and Vidius. The one, it appears, alleges in two short verses that Nicias owes him money. The other, like an Aristarchus, cavils at them. I, like an old critic, am to decide whether they are Nicias or Spurius." Again, in a letter to Atticus, he says, "As to what you write about Nicias, nothing could give me greater pleasure than to have him with me, if I was in a position to enjoy his society. But my province is to me a place of retirement and solitude. Sicca easily reconciled himself to this state of things, and therefore I would prefer having him. Besides, you are well aware of the feebleness and the nice and luxurious habits of our friend Nicias. Why should I be the means of making him uncomfortable when he can afford me no pleasure? At the same time, I value his goodwill." Linnaeus was a freedman of Pompey the Great, and attended him in most of his expeditions. On the death of his patron and his sons, he supported himself by teaching in a school which he opened near the temple of Tellus in the Carium, in the quarter of the city where the house of the Pompey stood. Such was his regard for his patron's memory that when Sallust described him as having a brazen face and a shameless mind, he lashed the historian in a most bitter satire, as a bull's spizzle, a gormandizer, a braggart, and a tippler, a man whose life and writings were equally monstrous, besides charging him with being a most unskillful plagiarist who borrowed the language of Cato and other old writers. It is related that, in his youth, having escaped from slavery by the contrivance of some of his friends, he took refuge in his own country, and that after he had applied himself to the liberal arts, he brought the price of his freedom to his former master, who, however, struck by his talents and learning, gave him manumission gratuitously. Quintus Caecilius, an Epirot by descent, but born at Tusculum, was a freedman of Atticus Satrius, a Roman knight, to whom Cicero addressed his epistles. He became the tutor of his patron's daughter, who was contracted to Marcus Agrippa, but, being suspected of an illicit intercourse with her, and sent away on that account, he betook himself to Cornelius Gallus, and lived with him on terms of the greatest intimacy, which, indeed, was imputed to Gallus as one of his heaviest offences by Augustus. Then, after the condemnation and death of Gallus, he opened a school, but had few pupils, and those very young, nor any belonging to the higher orders, excepting the children of those he could not refuse to admit. He was the first, it is said, who held disputations in Latin, and who began to lecture on Virgil and the other modern poets, which the verse of Domitius Marsus points out. Epirota tenelorum nutricula vatum. The epirot who, with tender care, our unfledged poets nursed. Varius Flaccus, a freedman, distinguished himself by a new mode of teaching, for it was his practice to exercise the wits of his scholars by encouraging emulation among them, not only proposing the subjects on which they were to write, but offering rewards for those who were successful in the contest. These consisted of some ancient, handsome, or rare book. Being, in consequence, selected by Augustus as preceptor to his grandsons, he transferred his entire school to the Palatium, but with the understanding that he should admit no fresh scholars. The hall in Catiline's house, which had then been added to the palace, was assigned him for his school, with a yearly allowance of 100,000 sesterces. He died of old age, in the reign of Tiberius. There is a statue of him in Praeneste, in the semicircle at the lower side of the forum, where he had set up calendars arranged by himself and inscribed on slabs of marble. Lucius Cursitius, a native of Tarentum, and in rank a freedman, had the cognomen of Pasidus, which he afterwards changed for Pansa. His first employment was connected with the stage, and his business was to assist the writers of farces. After that, he took to giving lessons in a gallery attached to a house, until his commentary on the Smyrna so brought him into notice that the following lines were written on him. Uni crassitio se credere Smyrna probavit, desinite in docti coniugio hanc petere, soli crassitio se dixit nubere veli, intima cui soli nota sua extiterint. Crassitius only counts on Smyrna's love. Fruitless the wooings of the unlettered prove. Crassitius she receives with loving arms, for he alone unveiled her hidden charms. However, after having taught many scholars, some of whom were of high rank, and amongst others Julius Antonius, the triumvir's son, so that he might even be compared with Varius Flaccus, he suddenly closed his school and joined the sect of Quintus Septimius the philosopher. Scribonius Aphrodisius, the slave and disciple of Orbilius, who was afterwards redeemed and presented with his freedom by Scribonia, the daughter of Libo, who had been the wife of Augustus, taught in the time of Varius, whose books on orthography he also revised, not without some severe remarks on his pursuits and conduct. Gnaeus Julius Hyginus, a freedman of Augustus, was a native of Spain, although some say he was born at Alexandria, and that when that city was taken, Caesar brought him, then a boy, to Rome. He closely and carefully imitated Cornelius Alexander, a Greek grammarian, who, for his antiquarian knowledge, was called by many Polyhistor, and by some History. He had the charge of the Palatine Library, but that did not prevent him from having many scholars, and he was one of the most intimate friends of the poet Ovid, and of Caius Licinius, the historian, a man of consular rank, who was related that Hyginus died very poor, and was supported by his liberality as long as he lived. Julius Modestus, who was a freedman of Hyginus, followed the footsteps of his patron in his studies and learning. Caius Melissus, a native of Spoletum, was freeborn, but having been exposed by his parents in consequence of quarrels between them, he received a good education from his foster father, by whose care and industry he was brought up, and was made a present of to Maecenas as a grammarian. Finding himself valued and treated as a friend, he preferred to continue in his state of servitude, although he was claimed by his mother, choosing rather his present condition than that which his real origin entitled him to. In consequence, his freedom was speedily given him, and he even became a favorite with Augustus. By his appointment, he was made curator of the library in the portico of Octavia, and, as he himself informs us, undertook to compose, when he was a sexagenarian, his books of witticisms, which are now called the Book of Jests. Of these, he accomplished 150, to which he afterwards added several more. He also composed a new kind of story about those who wore the toga, and called it Trabeat. Marcus Pomponius Marcellus, a very severe critic of the Latin tongue, who sometimes pleaded causes, in a certain address on the plaintiff's behalf, persisted in charging his adversary with making a solecism, until Cassius Severus appealed to the judges to grant an adjournment until his client should produce another grammarian, as he was not prepared to enter into a controversy respecting a solecism, instead of defending his client's rights. On another occasion, when he had found fault with some expression in a speech made by Tiberius, Ateius Capito affirmed that if it was not Latin, at least it would be so in time to come. "Capito is wrong," cried Marcellus. "It is certainly in your power, Caesar, to confer the freedom of the city on whom you please, but you cannot make words for us." Asinius Gallus tells us that he was formerly a pugilist in the following epigram. "Qui caput ad laivam decit glossemata nobis, praecipit, os nullum vel potius pugilis. Who ducked his head to shun another's fist, though he expound old saws, yet, well I wist, with pummeled nose and face, he is but a pugilist." Remius Polyman of Vicentia, the offspring of a bondwoman, acquired the rudiments of learning, first as the companion of a weaver's, and then of his master's son at school. Being afterwards made free, he taught at Rome, where he stood highest in the rank of the grammarians. But he was so infamous for every sort of vice that Tiberius and his successor Claudius publicly denounced him as an improper person to have the education of boys and young men entrusted to him. Still, his powers of narrative and agreeable style of speaking made him very popular, besides which he had the gift of making extempore verses. He also wrote a great many in various and uncommon meters. His insolence was such that he called Marcus Varro a hog, and bragged that letters were born and would perish with him, and that his name was not introduced inadvertently in the Bucolics, as Virgil divined that the Polyman would some day be the judge of all poets and poems. He also boasted that having once fallen into the hands of robbers, they spared him, on account of the celebrity his name had acquired. He was so luxurious that he took the bath many times in a day, nor did his means suffice for his extravagance, although his school brought him in 40,000 sesterces yearly, and he received not much less from his private estate, which he managed with great care. He also kept a broker's shop for the sale of old clothes, and it is well known that a vine he planted himself yielded 350 bottles of wine. But the greatest of all his vices was his unbridled licentiousness in his commerce with women, which he carried to the utmost pitch of foul indecency. They tell a droll story of some one who met him in a crowd, and upon his offering to kiss him could not escape the salute. "Master," said he, "do you want to mouth every one you meet with in a hurry?" Marcus Valerius Probus of Berytus, after long aspiring to the rank of centurion, being at last tired of waiting, devoted himself to study. He had met with some old authors at a bookseller's shop in the provinces, where the memory of ancient times still lingers, and is not quite forgotten as it is at Rome. Being anxious carefully to reperuse these, and afterwards to make acquaintance with other works of the same kind, he found himself an object of contempt, and was laughed at, for his lectures, instead of their gaining him fame or profit. Still, however, he persisted in his purpose, and employed himself in correcting, illustrating, and adding notes to many works which he had collected, his labors being confined to the province of a grammarian, and nothing more. He had, properly speaking, no scholars, but some few followers, for he never taught in such a way as to maintain the character of a master, but was in the habit of admitting one or two, perhaps at most three or four, disciples in the afternoon. And while he lay at ease and chatted freely on ordinary topics, he occasionally read some book to them, but that did not often happen. He published a few slight treatises on some subtle questions, besides which he left a large collection of observations on the language of the ancients. End of Lives of the Eminent Grammarians. Recording by Leni in Rio de Janeiro, 2008.
Lives of the Eminent Rhetoricians, from the Lives of the 12 Caesars by Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Anne Cheng. The Lives of the 12 Caesars by Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus. Translated by Alexander Thompson and edited by T. Forrester. Lives of the Eminent Rhetoricians, paragraphs 1 through 6. Rhetoric also, as well as grammar, was not introduced amongst us till a late period, and with still more difficulty, inasmuch as we find that at times the practice of it was even prohibited. In order to leave no doubt of this, I will subjoin an ancient decree of the Senate, as well as an edict of the censors. In the consulship of Gaius Fannius Strabo at Marcus Palearius Messala, the praetor Marcus Pomponius moved the Senate that an act be passed respecting philosophers and rhetoricians. In this matter they have decreed as follows. It shall be lawful for Marcus Pomponius the praetor to take such measures and make such provisions as the good of the Republic and the duty of his office require, that no philosophers or rhetoricians be suffered at Rome. After some interval, the censor Cnaeus Domitius Ahenobarbus and Lucius Licinius Crassus issued the following edict upon the same subject. It is reported to us that certain persons have instituted a new kind of discipline, that our youth resort to their schools, that they have assumed the title of Latin rhetoricians, and that young men waste their time there for whole days together. Our ancestors have ordained what instruction it is fitting their children should receive, and what schools they should attend. These novelties, contrary to the customs and instructions of our ancestors, we neither approve, nor do they appear to us good. Wherefore it appears to be our duty that we should notify our judgment both to those who keep such schools, and those who are in the practice of frequenting them, that they meet our disapprobation. However, by slow degrees, rhetoric manifested itself to be a useful and honourable study, and many persons devoted themselves to it, both as a means of defence and of acquiring a reputation. Cicero declaimed in Greek until his praetorship, but afterwards, as he grew older, in Latin also, and even in the consulship of Hirtius and Pansa, whom he calls his great and noble disciples. Some historians state that Gnaeus Pompey resumed the practice of declaiming even during the civil war, in order to be better prepared to argue against Gaius Curio, a young man of great talents, to whom the defence of Caesar was entrusted. They say, likewise, that it was not forgotten by Mark Antony, nor by Augustus, even during the War of Modena. Nero also declaimed, even after he became emperor, in the first year of his reign, which he had done before in public but twice. Many speeches of orators were also published. In consequence, public favour was so much attracted to the study of rhetoric, that a vast number of professors and learned men devoted themselves to it, and it flourished to such a degree that some of them raised themselves by it to the rank of senators and the highest offices. But the same mode of teaching was not adopted by all, nor indeed did individuals always confine themselves to the same system, but each varied his plan of teaching according to circumstances. For they were accustomed in stating their argument with the utmost clearness to use figures and apologies, to put cases as circumstances required, and to relate facts, sometimes briefly and succinctly, and at other times more at large and with greater feeling. Nor did they omit on occasion to resort to translations from the Greek, and to expatiate in the praise, or to launch their censures on the faults of illustrious men. They also dealt with matters connected with everyday life, pointing out such as are useful and necessary, and such as are hurtful and needless. They had occasion often to support the authority of fabulous accounts, and to detract from that of historical narratives, which sought the Greeks call propositions, refutations, and corroboration, until by a gradual process they have exhausted these topics, and arrive at the gist of the argument. Among the ancients, subjects of controversy were drawn either from history, as indeed some are even now, or from actual facts of recent occurrence. It was therefore the custom to state them precisely, with details of the names of places. We certainly so find them collected and published, and it may be well to give one or two of them literally by way of example. A company of young men from the city, having made an excursion to Ostia in the summer season, and going down to the beach, fell in with some fishermen who were casting their nets in the sea. Having bargained with them for the haul, whatever it might turn out to be, for a certain sum, they paid down the money. They waited a long time while the nets were being drawn, and when at last they were dragged on shore, there was no fish in them, but some gold sewn up in a basket. The buyers claim the haul as theirs, the fishermen assert that it belongs to them. Again, some dealers having to land from a ship at Brundisium a cargo of slaves, among which there was a handsome boy of great value, they, in order to deceive the collectors of the customs, smuggled him ashore in the dress of a free-born youth, with a bullum hung about his neck. The fraud easily escaped detection. They proceed to Rome. The affair becomes a subject of judicial inquiry. It is alleged that the boy was entitled to his freedom because his master had voluntarily treated him as free. Formerly, they called these by a Greek term, syntaxes, but of late controversies. But they may be either fictitious cases, or those which come under trial in the courts. Of the eminent professors of this science, of whom any memorials are extant, it would not be easy to find many others than those of whom I shall now proceed to give an account. Lucius Plotius Gallus. Of him Marcus Tullius Cicero thus writes to Marcus Titinius, "I remember well that when we were boys, one Lucius Plotius first began to teach Latin, and as great numbers flocked to his school, so that all who were most devoted to study were eager to take lessons from him, it was a great trouble to me that I too was not allowed to do so. I was prevented, however, by the decided opinion of men of the greatest learning, who considered that it was best to cultivate the genius by the study of Greek. This same Gallus, for he lived to a great age, was pointed at by Marcus Caelius, in a speech which he was forced to make in his own cause, as having supplied his accuser, Atracinus, with materials for his charge. Suppressing his name, he says that such a rhetorician was like barley bread, compared to a wheaten loaf, windy, chaffy, and coarse. Lucius Octocilius Pilatus is said to have been a slave, and according to the old custom, chained to the door like a watchdog, until, having been presented with his freedom for his genius and devotion to learning, he drew up for his patron the act of accusation in a cause he was prosecuting. After that, becoming a professor of rhetoric, he gave instructions to Gnaeus Pompey the Great, and composed an account of his actions, as well as those of his father, being the first freedman, according to the opinion of Cornelius Nepos, who ventured to write history, which before his time had not been done by anyone who was not of the highest ranks in society. About this time, Epidius, having fallen into disgrace for bringing a false accusation, opened a school of instruction, in which he taught, among others, Mark Antony and Augustus. On one occasion, Gaius Canutius jeered them for presuming to belong to the party of the consul Isauricus in his administration of the Republic, upon which he replied that he would rather be the disciple of Isauricus than of Epidius, the false accuser. This Epidius claimed to be descended from Epidius Nuncio, who, as ancient traditions assert, fell into the fountain of the river Sarnus when the streams were overflown, and not being afterwards found, was reckoned among the number of the gods. Sextus Clodius, a native of Sicily, a professor both of Greek and Latin eloquence, had bad eyes and a facetious tongue. It was a saying of his that he lost a pair of eyes from his intimacy with Mark Antony, the triumvir. Of his wife Fulvia, when there was a swelling in one of her cheeks, he said that she tempted the point of his style. Nor did Antony think any the worse of him for the joke, but quite enjoyed it. and soon afterwards, when Antony was consul, he even made him a large grant of land, which Cicero charges him with in his Philippics. "You patronize," he said, "a master of the schools for the sake of his buffoonery, and make a rhetorician one of your pot companions," allowing him to cut his jokes on any one he pleased. A witty man, no doubt, but it was an easy matter to say smart things of such as you and your companions. But listen, conscript fathers, while I tell you what reward was given to this rhetorician, and let the wounds of the Republic be laid bare to view. You assigned 2,000 acres of the Leontine territory to Sextus Clodius the rhetorician, and, not content with that, exonerated the estate from all taxes. Hear this, and learn from the extravagance of the grant how little wisdom is displayed in your acts. Gaius Albutius Silus of Novara, while in the execution of the office of aedile in his native place, he was sitting for the administration of justice, was dragged by the feet from the tribunal by some persons against whom he was pronouncing a decree. In great indignation at this usage, he made straight for the gate of the town, and proceeded to Rome. There he was admitted to fellowship, and lodged with Plancus the orator, whose practice it was, before he made a speech in public, to set up someone to take the contrary side in the argument. The office was undertaken by Albutius with such success that he silenced Plancus, who did not venture to put himself in competition with him. This bringing him into notice, he collected an audience of his own, and it was his custom to open the question proposed for debate sitting. But as he warmed with the subject, he stood up, and made his peroration in that posture. His declamations were of different kinds, sometimes brilliant and polished. At others, that they might not be thought to savour too much of the schools, he curtailed them of all ornament, and used only familiar phrases. He also pleaded causes, but rarely, being employed in such as were of the highest importance, and in every case undertaking the peroration only. In the end he gave up practising in the forum, partly from shame, partly from fear. For, in a certain trial before the court of the 100, having lashed the defendant as a man void of natural affection for his parents, he called upon him by a bold figure of speech to swear by the ashes of his mother and father which lay unburied. His adversary taking him up for the suggestion, and the judges frowning upon it, he lost his cause and was much blamed. At another time, on a trial for murder at Milan, before Lucius Piso the proconsul, having to defend the culprit, he worked himself up to such a pitch of vehemence that in a crowded court, who loudly applauded him, notwithstanding all the efforts of the lictor to maintain order, he broke out into a lamentation on the miserable state of Italy, then in danger of being again reduced, he said, into the form of a province. And, turning to the statue of Marcus Brutus, which stood in the forum, he invoked him as the founder and vindicator of the liberties of the people. For this he narrowly escaped a prosecution. Suffering at an advanced period of life from an ulcerated tumour, he returned to Novara, and, calling the people together in a public assembly, addressed them in a set speech of considerable length, explaining the reasons which induced him to put an end to existence. And this he did by abstaining from food. End of Lives of the Eminent Rhetoricians.
Lives of the Poets, from the Lives of the 12 Caesars by Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Lives of the 12 Caesars by Gaius Suetonius Tranquillus, translated by Alexander Thompson and edited by T. Forrester. The Lives of the Poets. The Life of Terence. Publius Terentius Afer, a native of Carthage, was a slave at Rome, of the senator Terentius Lucanus, who, struck by his abilities and handsome person, gave him not only a liberal education in his youth, but his freedom when he arrived at years of maturity. Some say that he was a captive taken in war, but this, as Finastella informs us, could by no means have been the case, since both his birth and death took place in the interval between the termination of the Second Punic War and the commencement of the Third. Nor, even supposing that he had been taken prisoner by the Numidian or Gutellian tribes, could he have fallen into the hands of a Roman general, as there was no commercial intercourse between the Italians and Africans until after the fall of Carthage. Terence lived in great familiarity with many persons of high station, and especially with Scipio Africanus and Caius Delius, whose favour he is even supposed to have purchased by the foulest means. But Fenestella reverses the charge, contending that Terence was older than either of them. Cornelius Nepos, however, informs us that they were all of nearly equal age, and Porcius intimates a suspicion of this criminal commerce in the following passage. While Terence plays the wanton with the great, and recommends himself to them by the meretricious ornaments of his person, while, with greedy ears, he drinks in the divine melody of Africanus's voice, while he thinks of being a constant guest at the table of Furius and the handsome Laelius, while he thinks that he is fondly loved by them, and often is invited to Albinum for his youthful beauty, he finds himself stripped of his property and reduced to the lowest state of indigence. Then, withdrawing from the world, he betook himself to Greece, where he met his end, dying at Strymphalos, a town in Arcadia. What availed him the friendship of Scipio, of Laelius, or of Furius, three of the most affluent nobles of that age? They did not even minister to his necessities so much as provide to him a hired house, to which his slave might return with the intelligence of his master's death. He wrote comedies, the earliest of which, the Andrea, having to be performed at the public spectacles, is given by the Aediles. He was commanded to read it first before Caecilius, having been introduced while Caecilius was at supper, and being meanly dressed, he is reported to have read the beginning of the play seated on a low stool near the great man's couch. But after reciting a few verses, he was invited to take his place at table, and having supped with his host, went through the rest to his great delight. This play and five others were received by the public with similar applause, although Volcatius, in his enumeration of them, says that the Hecyra must not be reckoned among these. The eunuch was even acted twice in the same day, and earned more money than any comedy, whoever was the writer, had ever done before, namely 8,000 sesterces, besides which a certain sum accrued to the author for the title. But Varro prefers the opening of the Adelphi to that of Menander. It is very commonly reported that Terence was assisted in his works by Laelius and Scipio, with whom he lived in such great intimacy. He gave some currency to this report himself, nor did he ever attempt to defend himself against it, except in a light way, as in the prologue to the Adelphi. Nam quod isti duncat malevi, hominis nihilis, hunc adjure, acidec una scribere, quod ili maledictim vehemens existimant, em laudem hic ducit maximum, cum illis placet, qui vobis universis e populo placent, quorum opera in bello, in otio, in negatio, suo quisque tempore usus est sine superbia. For this, which malice tells that certain noble persons assist the bard, and ride in concert with him, that which they deem a heavy slander, he esteems his greatest praise, that he can please those who in war, in peace, as counsellors, have rendered you the dearest services, and ever borne their faculties so meekly. Common. He appears to have protested against this imputation with less earnestness, because the notion was far from being disagreeable to Laelius and Scipio. It therefore gained ground, and prevailed in after times. Quintus Memmius, in his speech in his own defence, says, Publius Africanus, who borrowed from Terence a character which he had acted in private, brought it on the stage in his name. Nepos tells us he found in some book that C. Laelius, when he was on some position at Puteoli, on the Calends, the 1st of March, being requested by his wife to rise early, begged her not to suffer him to be disturbed, as he had gone to bed late, having been engaged in writing with more than usual success. On her asking him to tell her what he had been writing, he repeated the verses which are found in the Houtin Timoromenos. Satis pol proterve, miseri promessa, Houtin, 4:4:1. In faith, the rogue's serious is impudent pretences. Santra is of opinion that if Terence required any assistance in his compositions, he would not have had recourse to Scipio and Laelius, who were then very young men, but rather to Sulpicius Gallus, an accomplished scholar, who had been the first to introduce his plays at the games given by the consuls, or to Q. Fabius Lobbio, or Marcus Popilius, both men of consular rank, as well as poets. It was for this reason that, in alluding to the assistance he had received, he did not speak of his coadjutors as very young men, but as persons of whose services the people had full experience in peace, in war, and in the administration of affairs. After he had given his comedies to the world, at a time when he had not passed his 35th year, in order to avoid suspicion, as he found others publishing their works under his name, or else to make himself acquainted with the modes of life and habits of the Greeks, for the purpose of exhibiting them in his plays, he withdrew from home, to which he never returned. Volcatius gives this account of his death. Sudit afer se populo dedit commodius, iter hic in asiam fecit, navem cum semel consinit, visus nunquam est, sic vita vacit. When Offer had produced 6 plays for the entertainment of the people, he embarked for Asia, but from the time he went on board ship he was never seen again. Thus he ended his life. Q. Consequentius reports that he perished at sea on his voyage back from Greece, and that 108 plays, of which he had made a version from Menander, were lost with him. Others say that he died at Stymphalos, in Arcadia, or in Leucadia, during the consulship of Sen Cornius Dolabella and Marcus Fulvius Nobilior, worn out with a severe illness and with a grief and regret for the loss of his baggage, which he had sent forward in a ship that was wrecked and contained the last new plays he had written. In person, Terence is reported to have been rather short and slender, with a dark complexion. He had an only daughter, who was afterwards married to a Roman knight, and he left also 20 acres of garden ground on the Appian Way, at the Villa of Mars. I therefore wonder the more how Porcius could have written the verses Nihil Publius, Scipio Profuit, Nihil et Laelius, Nihil Furius, Tres per edem tempus qui agitabant nobilis facilime, Iorum ille opera nidomum quidem habituet conductitiam, saltum et esset, quo referet obitum domini servilis. Africanus places him at the head of all the comic writers, declaring in his Compitalia, Terentio non similem disis quempium, Terence's equal cannot soon be found. On the other hand, Volcatius reckons him inferior not only to Naevius, Plautus, and Caecilius, but also to Licinius. Cicero pays him this high compliment in his Limo, Tu quoque qui solus lecto sermone, Terenti, conversum expressumque Latina voce mandrenum, in medio populi sedatis vocibus offers, quid cum loquens, ac omnia dulcia dicens. You only, Terence, translated into Latin and clothed in choice language, the plays of Menander, and brought them before the public, who in crowded audiences hung upon hushed applause, grace marked each line and every period charmed. So also Caius Caesar, Tu quoque tu insumis, o dimidiate Menander, poneris et merito puris sermonis amator, lenibus atque atinam scriptus adjuncta fuerit vis, comica ut aquato vertis poleret honore, cum graces neca in hoc despectus parte jaceres, unum hac maseror, et doleo tibi dice Terenti. You, too, who divide your honors with Menander, will take your place among poets of the highest order, and justly, too, such is the purity of your style. Would only that to your graceful diction was added more comic force, that your works might equal in merit the Greek masterpieces, and your inferiority in this particular should not expose you to censure. This is my only regret. In this, Terence, I grieve to say you are wanting. The Life of Juvenal. D. Junius Juvenalis, who was either the son of a wealthy freedman or brought up by him, it is not known which, declaimed till the middle of life, more from the bent of his inclination than from any desire to prepare himself either for the schools or the forum. But having composed a short satire, which was clever enough, on Paris, the actor of pantomimes, and also on the poet of Claudius Nero, who was puffed up by having held some inferior military rank for 6 months only, he afterwards devoted himself with much zeal to that style of writing. For a while, indeed, he had not the courage to read them even to a small circle of auditors, but it was not long before he recited his satires to crowded audiences, and with entire success, and this he did twice or thrice, inserting new lines among those which he had originally composed. Quod non dant proseris, dabit histrio tu Camerinos, et Barius tu nobilum magna atria curus, praefectos Pelopia facit, Philomena tribunos. Behold, an actor's patronage affords a surer means of rising than a lord's, and wilt thou still the Camerino's court, or the halls of Barius resort, when tribunes Philopia can create, and Philomela prefix, who shall rule the state? At that time the player was in high favor at court, and many of those who fawned upon him were daily raised to posts of honor. Juvenal therefore incurred the suspicion of having covertly satirized occurrences which were then passing, and although 80 years old at that time, he was immediately removed from the city, being sent into honorable banishment as a prefect of a cohort, which was under orders to proceed to a station at the extreme frontier of Egypt. That sort of punishment was selected, as it appeared severe enough for an offense which was venial, and a mere piece of drollery. However, he died very soon afterwards, worn down by grief and weary of his life. The Life of Perseus. Aulus Perseus Flaccus was born on the day before the nones of December, 4th December, in the consulship of Fabius Persicus and L. Vitellius. He died on the 8th of the calends of December, in the consulship of Rubius Marius and Asinius Gallus. Though born at Volterra in Etruria, he was a Roman knight, allied both by blood and marriage to persons of the highest rank. He ended his days at an estate he had at the 8th milestone on the Appian Way. His father, Flaccus, who died when he was barely 6 years old, left him under the care of guardians, and his mother, Fulvia Selena, who afterwards married Fusius, a Roman knight, buried him also in a very few years. Perseus Flaccus pursued his studies at Volterra till he was 12 years old, and then continued them at Rome, under Remius Palaemon, the grammarian, and Virginius Flaccus, the rhetorician. Arriving at the age of 21, he formed a friendship with Aeneas Cortunus, which lasted through life, and from him he learned the rudiments of philosophy. Among his earliest friends were Caecius Bassus and Calpurnius Datura, the latter of whom died while Perseus himself was yet in his youth. Servilius Numanus he reverenced as a father. Through Cornutus he was introduced to Aeneas, as well as to Lucan, who was of his own age, and also a disciple of Cornutus. At that time Cornutus was a tragic writer. He belonged to the sect of the Stoics, and left behind him some philosophical works. Lucan was so delighted with the writings of Perseus Flaccus that he could scarcely refrain from giving loud tokens of applause while the author was reciting them, and declared that they had the true spirit of poetry. It was late before Perseus made the acquaintance of Seneca, and then he was not much struck with his natural endowments. At the house of Cornutus he enjoyed the society of two very learned and excellent men, who were then zealously devoting themselves to philosophical inquiries, namely, Claudius Agaternus, a physician from Lacedaemon, and Petronius Aristocrates, of Magnesia, men whom he held in the highest esteem, and with whom he vied in their studies, as they were of his own age, being younger than Cornutus. During nearly the last 10 years of his life, he was much beloved by Thrasius, so that he sometimes travelled abroad in his company, and his cousin Arria was married to him. Perseus was remarkable for gentle manners, for a modesty amounting to bashfulness, a handsome form, and an attachment to his mother, sister, and aunt, which was most exemplary. He was frugal and chaste. He left his mother and sister 20,000 sesterces, requesting his mother, in a written codicil, to present to Cornutus, as some say, 100 sesterces, or, as others, 20 pounds of wrought silver, besides about 700 books, which indeed included his whole library. Cornutus, however, would only take the books, and gave up the legacy to the sisters, whom his brother had constituted his heirs. He wrote seldom, and not very fast. Even the work we possessed he left uncomplete. Some verses are wanting at the end of the book, but Cornutus thoughtlessly recited it, as if it was finished, and on Caecius Bassus requesting to be allowed to publish it, he delivered it to him for that purpose. In his younger days Perseus had written a play, as well as an itinerary, with several copies of verses on Thrasius's father-in-law, and Arria's mother, who had made away with herself before her husband. But Cornutus used his whole influence with the mother of Perseus to prevail upon her to destroy these compositions. As soon as his book of satires was published, all the world began to admire it, and were eager to buy it up. He died of a disease in the stomach, in the 30th year of his age. But no sooner had he left school and his masters than he set to work with great vehemence to compose satires, from having read the 10th book of Lucilius, and made the beginning of that book his model, presently launching his invectives all around with so little scruple that he did not spare contemporary poets and orators, and even lashed Nero himself, who was then the reigning prince. The verse ran as follows. Auriculus asini mede rex habet. King Midas has an ass's ears. But Cornutus altered it thus. Auriculus asini quis non hehet. Who has not an ass's ears? In order that it might not be supposed that it was meant to apply to Nero. The Life of Horace. Horatius Flaccus was a native of Venetium, his father having been, by his own account, a freedman and collector of taxes, but, as it is generally believed, a dealer in salted provisions, for someone with whom Horace had a quarrel jeered him by saying, "How often have I seen your father wiping his nose with his fist?" In the Battle of Philippi he served as a military tribune, which post he filled at the instance of Marcus Brutus, the general, and having obtained a pardon, on the overthrow of his party, he purchased the office of scribe to a quaestor. Afterwards insinuating himself first into the good graces of Mecaenas, and then of Augustus, he secured no small share in the regard of both. And first, how much Mecaenas loved him may be seen by the epigram in which he says, "Nita viseribus meus, Horati, plus jam diligo, titium soldalum, geno tividius strigo siorum." But it was more strongly exhibited by Augustus, in a short sentence uttered in his last moments, "Be as mindful of Horatius Flaccus as you are of me." Augustus offered to appoint him as secretary, signifying his wishes to Mecaenas in a letter to the following effect, "Hitherto I have been able to write my own epistles to friends, but now I am too much occupied, and in an infirm state of health. I wish, therefore, to deprive you of our Horace. Let him leave, therefore, your luxurious table, and come to the palace, and he shall assist me in writing my letters." And upon his refusing to accept the office, he neither exhibited the smallest displeasure, nor ceased to heap upon him tokens of his regard. Letters of his are extant, from which I will make some short extracts to establish this. "Use your influence over me with the same freedom as you would do if we were living together as friends. In so doing you will be perfectly right, and guilty of no impropriety, for I could wish that our intercourse should be on that footing, if your health admitted of it." And again, "How I hold you in memory you may learn from our friend Septimius, for I happened to mention you when he was present, and if you are so proud as to scorn my friendship, that is no reason why I should lightly esteem yours in return." Besides this, among other drolleries, he often called him his most immaculate penis, and his charming little man, and loaded him from time to time with proofs of his munificence. He admired his works so much, and was so convinced of their enduring fame, that he directed him to compose the secular poem, as well as that on the victory of his stepsons Tiberius and Drusus over the Vindelici, and for this purpose urged him to add, after a long interval, a fourth book of odes to the former three. After reading his sermons, in which he found no mention of himself, he complained in these terms, "You must know that I am very angry with you, because in most of your works of this description you do not choose to address yourself to me. Are you afraid that, in times to come, your reputation will suffer, in case it should appear that you lived on terms of intimate friendship with me?" And he wrung from him the eulogy which begins with, "Cum tot sustinius, et tanta negotia solus, res Italias armis tuteris, moribus ornis, legibus emendis, in publica commodi peccum, si longo sermone moro tua tempora." Caesar, Epist. 2:1. "While you alone sustain the important weight of Rome's affairs, so various and so great, while you the public weal with arms defend, adorn with morals, and with laws amend, shall not the tedious letter prove a crime that steals one moment of our Caesar's time?" Francis. In person, Horace was short and fat, as he is described by himself in his satires, and by Augustus in the following letter. "Dionysius has brought me your small volume, which, little as it is, not to blame you for that, I shall judge favorably. You seem to me, however, to be afraid lest your volume should be bigger than yourself. but if you are short in stature, you are corpulent enough. You may therefore, if you will, write in a quart, when the size of your volume is as large round as your paunch. It is reported that he was immoderately addicted to venery, for he is said to have had obscene pictures so disposed in a bedchamber lined with mirrors, that whichever way he looked, lascivious images might present themselves to his view. He lived for the most part in the retirement of his farm, on the confines of the Sabine and the Tiburtine territories, and his house is shown in the neighborhood of a little wood, not far from Tibur. Some elegies ascribed to him, and a prose epistle apparently written to commend himself to Mecaenas, have been handed down to us, but I believe that neither of them are genuine works of his, for the elegies are commonplace, and the epistle is wanting in perspicuity, a fault which cannot be imputed to his style. He was born on the 6th of the Ides of December, 27th December, in the consulship of Lucius Cotta and Lucius Torquatus, and died on the 5th of the Calends of December, 27th November, in the consulship of Caius Marcius Censorinus and Caius Asinius Gallus, having completed his 59th year. He made a nuncupatory will, declaring Augustus his heir, not being able, from the violence of his disorder, to sign one in due form. He was interred and lies buried on the skirts of the Esquiline Hill, near the tomb of Mecaenas. M. Aeneas Lucanus, a native of Corduba, first tried the powers of his genius in an encomium on Nero, at the Quinquennial Games. He afterwards recited his poem on the civil war carried on between Pompey and Caesar. His vanity was so immense, and he gave such liberty to his tongue, that in some preface, comparing his age and his first efforts with those of Virgil, he had the assurance to say, "And now what remains for me is to deal with a gnat." In his early youth, after being long informed of the sort of life his father led in the country, in consequence of an unhappy marriage, he was recalled from Athens by Nero, who admitted him into the circle of his friends, and even gave him the honor of the quaestorship, but he did not long remain in favor. Smarting at this, and having publicly stated that Nero had withdrawn, all of a sudden, without communicating with the Senate, and without any other motive than his own recreation, after this he did not cease to assail the emperor, both with foul words and with acts which are still notorious. So that on one occasion, when easing his bowels in the common privy, there being a louder explosion than usual, he gave vent to the nemistic of Nero. One would suppose it was thundering underground, in the hearing of those who were sitting there for the same purpose, and who took to their heels in much consternation. In a poem also, which was in every one's hands, he severely lashed both the emperor and his most powerful adherents. At length he became nearly the most active leader in Piso's conspiracy, and while he dwelt without reserve in many quarters on the glory of those who dipped their hands in the blood of tyrants, he launched out into open threats of violence, and carried them so far as to boast that he would cast the emperor's head at the feet of his neighbors. When, however, the plot was discovered, he did not exhibit any firmness of mind. A confession was wrung from him without much difficulty, and humbling himself to the most abject entreaties, he even named his innocent mother as one of the conspiracies, hoping that his want of natural affection would give him favor in the eyes of a parricidal prince. Having obtained permission to choose his mode of death, he wrote notes to his father, containing corrections of some of his verses, and having made a full meal, allowed a physician to open the veins in his arms. I have also heard it said that his poems were offered for sale, and commented upon, not only with care and diligence, but also in a trifling way. The Life of Pliny. Plinius Secundus, a native of New Como, having served in the wars with strict attention to his duties, in the rank of a knight, distinguished himself also by the great integrity with which he administered the high functions of a procurator for a long period in the several provinces entrusted to his charge. But still he devoted so much attention to literary pursuits that it would not have been an easy matter for a person who enjoyed entire leisure to have written more than he did. He comprised in 20 volumes an account of all the various wars carried on in successive periods with the German tribes. Besides this, he wrote a natural history, which extended to 7 books. He fell a victim to the calamitous event which occurred in Campania, for, having the command of the fleet at Misenum, when Vesuvius was throwing up a fiery eruption, he put to sea with his galleys for the purpose of exploring the causes of the phenomenon close on the spot. but being prevented by contrary winds from sailing back, he was suffocated in the dense cloud of dust and ashes. Some, however, think that he was killed by his slave, having implored him to put an end to his sufferings, when he was reduced to the last extremity by the fervent heat. End of the Lives of the Poets. End of the Lives of the 12 Caesars.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.